The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
I guess it was a couple months ago, Christina Hoff Summers was doing a talk at Lewis and Clark, the law school there.
1 in 4 women will be raped, 2 in 3 battered, cheated out of 25% of their salaries. All of these claims are reckless exaggerations.
And she had been brought in by the Federalist Society, which is a conservative group that gets money from the Koch brothers to put out conservative ideas into the ether. And so as she was giving her, as she was trying to give her speech, some student protesters went up, they interrupted her speech.
Christina Summers has repeatedly demonized the suffering of women.
An administrator asked her to wrap up and to move into the question and answer segment. Afterwards, there was a tremendous amount of media coverage on this incident. So she tweeted about it, at my last count, at least 70 or 80 times. There were op-eds in the New York Times, the National Review, New York Mag, all sorts of places.
This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Taylor Quimby, in the studio with producer Jimmy Gutierrez. So Jimmy, what's going on here?
So this exchange is taking place at Lewis and Clark in Portland, Oregon. And Taylor, as you know, I've been covering some of the tensions at the University of New Hampshire over the past year, and it's been really interesting what's happening around this idea of free speech and how it's playing out on campuses nationally. I gave a call to Mara Uehara, and that's who we heard. She's kind of telling us the story which happened on campus, and she's written about this topic, and she's been really trying to decode the words free speech in today's context.
I feel like I'm hearing more and more about these conflicts happening on universities especially.
Yeah, you definitely are. Mara says there's this strategy that goes kind of into eliciting this reaction out of students. In the Summers video, when the students are shouting her down, she actually looks towards the camera and smiles.
The idea here is that, like, this is good material.
Exactly. And there's a huge audience for this. I asked Mari about the Summers interruption and if this tactic, deplatforming or interrupting a speaker, is a good idea.
I don't think it's a sound tactic, because instead of bringing attention to, say, what they thought might be issues with her speech, they're instead making the whole issue a free speech issue or an issue around civility on campus. And I think students have to understand that when they're protesting, particularly in the social media age, they're performing not just for their classmates who might agree with them, might not want a particular speaker on campus, but also for the larger world. And they should be viewing it as a marketing opportunity and trying to think about whether or not they are marketing their stance in an effective way or not.
And who are some of the free speech warriors that are going around and speaking on campus, and kind of what are the messages that they're putting out there?
A lot of it is this whole thing about being anti-identity politics or anti-political correctness. And tied in with that are these ideas that the left is increasingly intolerant to other ideas and not willing to debate with other people. And so when students are trying to shut down a speech by pulling fire alarms or shouting people down, or, you know, as some campuses we've seen actual violence, they're kind of playing into that narrative that the left is not willing to debate their ideas.
Just this week, President Trump said about immigrants, quote, "They're not human, they're animals." What do we know about normalizing certain speech and violence?
To answer that question just very briefly, when I spoke to the Anti-Defamation League, they have extremist researchers there. When I spoke to Marilyn Mayo, who is an extremism researcher at the Anti-Defamation League, she told me when you see a rise in the acceptability of denigrating speech towards, say, different racial groups, you also see a rise in incidents. It's not a complete coincidence that in the aftermath of Trump, we're also seeing political candidates in California who want Jews out of the country, or in Wisconsin, an open neo-Nazi running, which is not to say they didn't exist before. Obviously, David Duke was running years before Trump, but there's certainly growing acceptance in a certain segment of the population for being openly racist. And it's also funny that it's at the same time that people are saying that there's too much political correctness in society.
So I wanted to speak with Mari because of an event that took place this past May 1st.
What happened then?
So some students from the University of New Hampshire invited Dave Rubin to speak on campus. And nothing too serious happened, but there were protesters at the talk, and his speech was interrupted.
And who is Dave Rubin?
So Dave Rubin is a political commentator, and he hosts The Rubin Report. It's his online-based talk show. And I've got to say that Uehara makes it very clear he's not alt-right himself, but oftentimes he invites on those people who are and would be considered alt-right, and he co-signs their ideas without challenging them.
You mean like he has him... They express themselves, and he kind of, like, gives them the platform.
Correct. And we've got a clip that kind of gets to that exactly. Here's an episode with him and Stefan Molyneux, and he's asking a question about the genetic differences between race and intelligence.
I'm not a geneticist.
Yes.
So genetic in what regard? I mean, if we took the brain of a 25-year-old black man and the brain of a 25-year-old white man, what is it that they're doing that...
Different sizes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To be clear, Molyneux is not a scientist. He's considered alt-right by Politico and The Washington Post. But on Tuesday, May 1st, Dave Rubin brought his ideas and his provocative style to UNH.
I guarantee you, you're not going to hear anything remotely close to hate speech or anything like that. There actually is no such thing as hate speech, and we'll talk about that too, but you're not going to hear any hate out of me, I guarantee you.
He riled up a campus that's been confronted with a steep rise in bias incidents since the 2016 election. The event even got moved to the Whitmore Center when campus police worried about outside agitators.
Thank you, guys. Wow. I got to tell you guys, I did not think my day was going to end up in a hockey rink when I woke up this morning.
It only took a few minutes before a couple of students interrupted him with chants of Black Lives Matter. He urged the disruptors in the crowd to engage with him, goading them to ask him a question. About 30 minutes in, he formally opened things up to the Q&A portion of his talk. I spoke to one student who was there that day whose free speech hardly ever goes unchallenged.
It's how nicely can I present my point to convince the person in front of me. So that's really tolling, and that I'm always like, I have to plan ahead. What am I going to say? How am I going to say it?
Nuran Al-Abdallah is a sophomore at UNH. As a first-generation Arab American, she says she often has to self-police her tone when she speaks about politics.
Have to be the right amount witty and funny, you know, to show people not to be afraid of me. It's really calculated in how I have to, like, respond to people.
For example, when Rubin singles her out earlier in his talk...
What do you got for me? She's mouthing something at me. What do you got?
She tells him, nice suit.
Not bad, you know. It's all right.
Nuran says this is a technique she uses hoping to loosen up who's ever in front of her. On May 1st, it was Rubin.
Granted, I definitely look back now and I wish I worded things maybe... you know, to be more articulate, to make clearer points. But at the end of the day, I was still civil. I was still, quote unquote, having the free exchange of ideas that Dave claims that he wants people to have. And it's what surprised me was, you know, the response from him.
In the video Rubin posted online, Nuran is wearing a white tee under a camouflage button-up. She's standing in the middle of the aisle with the mic in one hand, and she's got a very relaxed lean. You can almost hear it when she speaks.
What's your background?
What,
you
so
are
you can
gay?
Play some ridiculous
No, I just have a question. I have a question.
Yeah.
You are gay and you are Jewish, correct?
Yeah.
Nuran asks him if he thinks there's a connection between anti-Semitic speech and anti-Semitic violence.
And I really thought that would be an easy question. I feel like we've learned our entire lives that acts of violence against Jews, most notably in the Holocaust, you know, didn't happen overnight. They happened through years of systematic dehumanization, which definitely falls under the umbrella of free speech. So I didn't think it would be too hard of a question.
Against Jewish
people. You
can't directly call for violence to people. But what you can do, it's the exchange of freedom. Would you prefer...
Do you think there's a correlation between hating Jews and wanting to kill them? Yes or no question.
You're asking me questions. All right, let's move on. Yes or no, I'm in a hostage situation over here.
And you know, it's really the last few minutes of the encounter where it really hits the fan, and that was like the most blatant hypocrisy to me, that it wasn't about, you know, talking or discussion or dialogue, because he goes, you're not oppressed, you're entitled. Again, I haven't claimed I'm oppressed. You don't call somebody entitled in a conversation where they just happen to be asking hard questions.
She said afterwards she talked to people who like Ruben and attended the event. Some told her her questions came off combative, but even more told her they felt it wasn't a discussion from his end. The thing is, Niran hasn't always been this outspoken. In fact, she's had to get used to fitting in wherever she goes. While she was born in New Jersey, her and her family moved to Portsmouth 10 years ago.
I definitely always felt like I was othered because I didn't do everything that all the other kids did. You know, everybody was bringing in PB&Js and I was bringing in like leftover like stuffed grape leaves. But not just that, like, why does your mother wear that? Like, why aren't you celebrating Christmas or Halloween with us?
And that feeling of not fitting in, well, it was magnified when she started college last year at UNH, months before Trump won the 2016 election, and the campus saw a steep rise in bias incidents.
A week after the election, I was walking around in the mob wearing a t-shirt that had Arabic on it. And I had two guys walk right by me, look straight at my shirt and go, like, go home. And I went up to the Office of Multicultural Student Affairs and I was laughing as I told the story. And they were like, no, you need to report this.
She says she wasn't laughing because it was hurtful, but because of how ridiculous it all sounded to her.
Yeah, I'm like literally born in Jersey, so I don't know how much more American I have to be, but I guess it's not enough.
Niran says the racism she's dealt with on campus is pretty minimal compared to her Black peers. But if anything is wearing her down, it's the microaggressions, acts of indirect racism that can be hard to spot.
This whole, like, if you don't like it, well, why do you live here? It's not really said to people who aren't people of color. Being a woman, especially though, it's like I have to counter the stereotype of, you know, the angry woman of color, the angry Arab woman.
It came to light last year that after 20 years, UNH's administration still hadn't made meaningful progress on demands for equity from its students. Then last year, the campus attracted national attention for Cinco de Mayo parties where students appropriated Mexican stereotypes.
So I was teaching, managing social justice organizations at UNH last spring, and Cinco de Mayo had happened and had gone by, and one of my white students came into class really flustered.
This is Kristen Forcilius. She was an adjunct professor at UNH last spring, and she's learned that free speech can often come with consequences.
And when I asked her what was going on, she said it was so tense on campus. She said people were just fighting, friends weren't talking anymore.
Kristen's the chair of the Oyster River Community Read and has done social work for 20 years. But it wasn't until this incident, she says, that she really dove into racism and white privilege in a meaningful way.
The biggest challenge that I heard was getting white people to recognize that race and racism is a problem in our state. That is the number one problem.
She says that many people will tell her that they're colorblind. They don't see other people's race, ethnicities, sexual orientation, or really anything that could lead to othering. Kristen says, of course, we all have good intentions, and we should be nice to people, whoever we meet. But by not addressing issues, we're perpetuating them.
It's not that we're not a welcoming community, but what are we doing beyond the initial welcome? So welcome, we're happy you're here, but are we really engaging with these people? Are we really inviting them in? Are we really providing them the resources they need to feel welcome? That's a whole different level of engagement.
To that end, Kristen and her organization have done a lot. They held a 6-week art series exploring race and bias issues creatively. They had an open mic inviting personal stories. They've had a film and lecture series, and even brought in Debbie Irving to speak to the group, the author of Waking Up White.
The model for East River Community Read is to use a book as a starting point to open up conversations that are challenging. They invite people to come in a non-threatening way to talk about things that they otherwise wouldn't talk about.
Her most recent event was a panel on race and bias at Oyster River High School. Invited to speak were Mike Ward, author of A Colored Man in Exeter, and whose family was the first to integrate the high school back in the late 50s. Also there was 85-year-old Carmen Buford Page. She knows all too well about UNH's track record. Born and raised in Southern California, she was hired by the university in 1989 as the Associate Dean for Student Affairs, the first woman of color hired in an executive position. After her presentation, we talked in a little room with a large vent in the front of the school's library. She said after she finished her PhD at UCLA and before taking the job, she didn't know much about New Hampshire.
And I looked up the racial, you know, mix to find out how many blacks were in New Hampshire. And I found out it was like maybe 2%, 2.2%. But I didn't really know what that meant. I didn't know that it meant that kids from northern New Hampshire had never seen a real live black person before. It was like I was some different species from somewhere. You know?
For Carmen, free speech on campus meant bumping into some ideas that she wasn't exposed to back in Los Angeles.
Do you want to talk about the pushback you got from some community members when you were first hired? I know there were some pamphlets or something left.
Oh, yes. Well, it wasn't community members. It was the Klan.
The Friday of Carmen's first week, the Klan had gone around putting up signs in all the university libraries saying where they were and how to get in touch with them.
And on all of the cars in the parking lot, there was a sheet that said, we have a cure for unwed motherhood, for crimes, for a long list of things. And on the other side, it showed a black man hanging from a tree.
I was a week into the job.
And my children found out about it. They called from California, said, come home. I said, no, I'm not coming home.
Things on the job proved to be just as challenging. As a senior administrator, she supervised 9 men and 1 woman. None of them had ever been managed by a person of color or a woman before. The insubordination started almost immediately.
Well, the very fact that the men who reported to me said they didn't have to do anything I said, and you know, and I said, no, you don't, but remember, I sign off on your budget. And so that got their attention. Yeah, it was always having to push forward.
Carmen says that's not her personality, just like it wasn't in Naran's to speak up. But Carmen felt the situation demanded it. This was a message she shared with her students earlier in the talk. But you said, I didn't want to take the lead, but because of who I was and where I was, I had to take the lead. Can you kind of speak to that?
Right, yeah. Well, ideally, I'm a shy person, and I just want to kick back and do my own thing. But because of where I was and because of where I am now, I feel that I have a responsibility to speak up, not only for my people, but for everybody, for the whole human race. There are a lot of good people who just don't say anything. And good people have got to speak out.
And speaking out is everyone's legal right. But there's a big difference between exercising free speech and uncritically promoting propaganda. In Mari Uehara's article, Free Speech Grifters, she writes that these speakers aren't interested in the free exchange of ideas. They're interested in caricature for clicks, social media followings, and monetization. They may also be unaware of the history of the places they visit.
As long as we continue to normalize xenophobia and, you know, just clear, blatant racism, just blatant racism, like we don't even need to dance around it anymore. It's blatant racism a lot of the time. As long as that continues to be normalized under the guise of, you know, it's free speech, people have a right to say what they want, it's important to note that when you say what you want and it happens to directly affect people's lives and, you know, their ability to be in public safely and their ability to, you know, exist in public, your speech does matter then.
This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Taylor Quimby in the studio right now with NHPR's environment and energy reporter, Annie Ropeek. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Taylor.
So since taking the position over the winter, you've been reporting all over the state. You've been to the seacoast to cover green crabs. You've been birding, I believe, at the crack of dawn.
Yes, the Super Bowl of birding.
You know, all the sorts of different landscapes of New Hampshire. But since you started in the dead of winter, you hadn't had much of an opportunity to head up into the White Mountains, had you?
No, I think the only time I'd been through Franconia Notch was in like a whiteout blizzard. So I got sort of the gray outsides, but not much sense of the scenery. So
Yeah. So I know that recently you got a chance to actually head up there and take a gander. What'd you think?
Yeah, no, it was great. It's beautiful in the spring. I got to drive all the way up to Crawford Notch and see all the colors and the people starting to come out and the hikers starting to come out. And I actually was going for a hike myself to kind of mark the start of spring.
And for the segment that we're about to hear, you got a chance to go up the Crawford Path, which is a very historic trail.
Indeed.
In fact, do they say trail or path?
It is called a path, I think, because it used to be a bridle path for horses.
Right.
But it is also technically a trail.
Okay. So the Crawford Path Trail.
Yes, exactly.
And you got to go with some folks that were probably the best tour guides you could possibly have for this sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to go with the real stewards of Crawford Path. So these are folks that work for the U.S. Forest Service, which manages the White Mountain National Forest, which is where we were, and also some avid trail people, just generally people who love hiking, people who love keeping up the trails and making them safe and fun for the rest of us to use. So we were checking out Crawford Path because it's turning 200 years old next year.
Wow.
It is, they think, the oldest continuously used hiking trail in the country. So it's the oldest trail that has stayed a trail and stayed in use the whole time that it's been a trail.
It's like a baseball statistic,
yeah,
you know, where it's like the best batting average for a batter in the month of August.
Yes, exactly, yeah. On a Wednesday. It's also the White Mountains' 100th birthday this year, just straight up. It's been 100 years since they first bought land for the White Mountains, since the first parcel was bought. So it's a big year for the forest. They're looking, you know, back and forwards, and Crawford Path is a great example of the work they're trying to do. And so they took me for a little tour.
Okay, let's hear it.
Before you can set out on Crawford Path, you have to climb some stairs, steep stairs made of big rocks at the edge of an Appalachian Mountain Club parking lot.
Probably about like one third of the rock is actually showing. So like two thirds is probably below. So what you see is actually just a small part of it. And these little rocks that look little are actually very big mostly.
Yeah.
If you can carry a rock, like if I can carry, one person can carry a rock, it's usually not big enough. Even if I'm really strong.
This is Andy Welch, the Assistant Recreation Program Leader for the U.S. Forest Service in the White Mountains. He says his work on keeping trails in tip-top shape is part of a long tradition.
Part of the skill set that's really hard, that tacit knowledge that's hard to like write down, is the experience of how to set a rock correctly. If it's wiggling when you set it, it's not set. It's gonna walk out eventually. So if we all these rocks we can jump on, we can move, we can probably hit with a car, some of them, and they're not going anywhere.
Yeah. Behind him, District Trails Manager Kristen Bailey is staple gunning a laminated sign to the post that marks the Crawford Path trailhead. It tells hikers that part of the trail is already closed for repairs, miles from here, up above the tree line where the delicate alpine habitat takes over.
You know, if they want the trail to be there, then they just need to work with us and respect our judgment and just skip that 0.7 miles.
Right. And the
it'll be there when they come back and right. It's open.
Yeah, very careful. And you go first in your bright yellow shirt.
Yeah, I know.
The mountain road is already pretty busy with spring traffic. We hurry across, past the edge of the woods, and on to Crawford Path. Right away, Andy points out a little row of boulders across the trail. It's called a rock water bar.
We're moving water from the trail as it sheds water. We want to get it off.
Kristen is staple gunning again as Andy digs a toe into the leaves and mud behind the rock bar.
So this has been cleaned pretty recently, but all this stuff here came down from up there. So as it washes, the idea is that both it breaks up that trail shed kind of watershed. So rather than have like a big gully washer ripping down the trail, these break up the force of that water and also trap material.
Let me translate that. This trail is a path of least resistance for people and for water. The ground on the trail is packed tight from foot traffic, so runoff has nowhere to go but straight down. These bars slow that flow and funnel it off underground that can absorb it. Trail workers clean out the bars a couple times a year. And now that I'm looking, I can see this kind of rock engineering all over Crawford Path. This trail is practically made of rocks, many of them placed just so. Border walls to keep hikers on the trail, stairs to stop a slope from wearing away, and water bars every 50 or 100 feet. We can also hear a waterfall getting closer as we climb the rocky trail through the trees. Matt Smith is with us too. He's the acting head of the new White Mountain Trail Collective. He says it brings together big historic groups like the Appalachian Mountain Club and the Forest Service with smaller local clubs to try a new approach to cooperative long-term trail maintenance.
We don't look at trails as infrastructure. We do annual grants and we get a tiny amount of dollars to do work that has to be done in a 3-month work window when hospitals and schools are looking at their infrastructure with a 25-year master plan. That's how we have to start looking at the national forest, and we have to start getting the resources behind it to actually get the work done more effectively.
This summer, they'll use a $150,000 grant from REI to divide and conquer a restoration blitz on all 8-plus miles of Crawford Path. Kristen Bailey says they can't usually afford to do more than a few weeks of chipping away at mounting trail problems. In fact, she can barely remember the last time Crawford had serious work done. It might have been 2011 after Hurricane Irene.
And everything just stops, and we can't even do the Band-Aid approach. Now we have to, you know, go into triage mode and close trails and just inspect stuff. And that's really when this whole thing kind of got started. That was the first time all the partners got together and were like, wow, maybe we need to start looking at things differently.
The federal government bought the first land for the White Mountain National Forest 100 years ago this week. Crawford Path is nearly twice that old. It was first cleared in 1819 by North Country entrepreneur Abel Crawford and his son Ethan Allen to take people and later horses up Mount Washington. Abel was the first guy to summit the mountain on horseback at age 75. And through all this history, through the start of the Appalachian Mountain Club and the National Forest, through the Great Depression, through two world wars, all that time, trail work was mostly about clearing vegetation and blazing trees. Andy says it wasn't until the 1970s that things started to change. Maintenance is more sophisticated now, but there's less money for it, and the trail is taking a greater beating from more destructive storms and more users than ever all year round, now with their trekking poles and bikes and dogs.
All those sort of factors coalesce into what's happening here, which is a trail that's highly erosive, requires a lot of maintenance, and is going to continue to be unstable until either someone fixes it or it gets to bedrock.
And it's going to require ongoing maintenance forevermore.
About half a mile up Crawford Path, we come to a worn wooden bridge over that wide waterfall tumbling down the length of the trail. Kristen crouches down to check it out.
What'd you see under there? Oh, I was just looking at the construction. I was trying to figure out if they, it looks like they drilled into the rock. Wow. I'm sure they picked this spot because of these good-sized rocks on either side as like natural abutments. They didn't have to install anything.
This bridge needs repairs that the Forest Service can't afford to make on its own. That's where the Trail Collective comes in. They can drum up volunteers, donations, and just understanding of how, Kristen says, hiking is about more than the selfie at the summit. It's also about stewardship.
Yeah, I think people just don't know. It's not that their intentions are bad. You know, I take selfies, you know. It's not, it's just a lack of knowledge and awareness, and I think that's the big goal. And skills, yep. You know, and sharing skills and making sure we, you know, keep these primitive skills that we still need out here alive and well.
They hope that message will come from the trail crews who will spread out on Crawford Path this summer, hoisting rocks on pulleys, clearing brush, and digging new stairs and gutters.
When 1,000 people plus a day, sometimes 1,000 people probably an hour coming on this trail, walk across 50 people doing work, if they don't get the message that this takes work and carry that forward, then we've done something wrong.
Yeah, we're going to make them trip over the trail workers. That'll show them.
Yeah, if you have to walk around a bunch of, like, yeah, sweaty, smelly trail workers.
As we head back down the path, Kristen keeps bolting off the trail as her colleagues point out rocks they might want to remember for use this summer.
That looked broken.
Oh, so should we grab it?
I think that if you peel away some of the moss, you might find that it's fractured enough to yank some pieces out.
And they're scouting for volunteers. Back near the trailhead, we come upon a big group of hikers just setting out for an Appalachian Mountain Club hut up near the tree line. Kate Gaverty of Keene is among them.
Do you What happened?
This trail is 200 years old next year, and it's being reworked this year and next year.
It's
top
the
to
oldest,
bottom.
The oldest continuously used hiking trail in the country.
That's wow. So cool.
And you guys
are
now part
of history.
We were just looking for some history. So
Kate says she and her friends hike in to spend the night in the forest a couple times a year. She says she loves being out here with no phone, no computer, just the woods and a mountain.
I feel like I can just be free and just do whatever I want, and it's so peaceful. Wind, you don't have to worry about anything. I love it.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks, guys.
Her group takes some volunteering info from Matt and Andy as we part ways. It's one small step toward making sure this trail will be here, cared for, into the next century. For Word of Mouth, I'm Annie Ropeek.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in the studio with Annie Ropeek, who you just heard from. She's NHPR's environment and energy reporter. And Annie, we were talking a little bit off the air about how this trail looked a lot different to you than you thought it would coming to New Hampshire.
Yeah, I mean, I picture a hiking trail, like I always go hiking at Audubon in Concord. You know, it's very manageable. It's low. It's like basically just a walking path through the woods. It's flat, not made of rocks. And Crawford was none of those things. It is basically a big rock staircase that leads up to the top of Mount Washington. And so you're climbing the whole time. I mean, there's some big steps and rocks everywhere. And it was intense. I mean, it was serious hiking.
Yeah.
Level three trail out of five.
And for folks who might be looking to hike on Crawford Trail, is there a way that they can find out, if there are obstacles or parts of the trail that they need to avoid?
Yeah, I think they're posting those on the Forest Service website usually for the trails. They keep those updated. And then when you go out there, you'll see signs that tell you what parts of the trail are closed. I think for the most part, like the lower parts of the trail, they're not going to have to actually detour people too much. You know, keep an eye on the signs and you might have to go over a mountain instead of around it, but that's part of the fun, right?
It is part of the fun. And thank you, Annie, so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Taylor.
This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Taylor Quimby, and I've brought producer Jimmy Gutierrez back into the studio.
Yeah.
We just heard about the history of the Crawford Path a little bit, and our next story is also about the wild.
Yes, it is. It's very, very wild.
So I remember the day that you pitched us this next story, Jimmy. You were very excited.
Yes, I was. This book came into our pod that spoke directly to my heart. It's called The Hyena Scientist. I was thinking the whole time, what have I done with my life that should be me?
I just like to picture this as a hyena who is a scientist.
Ooh.
Good concept for a cartoon.
That is. You know what? Hyenas need a lot of PR help.
They're super cool looking.
They are cool,
I'll give
right?
you that. I don't know that much more about them. And they've got the laughing thing.
They're very misunderstood. Even the laughing isn't laughing. Like they're communicating fear or excitement. And all of this, I had no idea. And they were my favorite animal. And I had no idea until this book came in. And I saw it was written by one of our favorite guests, Cy Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
And so what she does, this is a part of a series that she produces. It's called Scientists in the Field. And so she goes out and she spends time and profiles a scientist kind of in their natural habitat working with some animal that they're kind of an expert with.
So this one, I'll take it, has to do with hyenas.
This one has to do with hyenas.
So you went out and talked to Cy?
Yeah, I met up with her and her dog Thurber, and we sat down at the dining room table, and I wasted no time in getting into my praise of the book.
So the reason why this book made my life is because hyenas are my favorite animal in the animal kingdom. And I feel like the only press hyenas get is bad press.
You're right. What? Oh my God, this is your book.
This is my book.
This is for you.
Growing up, my brother and I had a subscription to the Wildlife Fact File. And if you didn't grow up with the Wildlife Fact Files, let me just say you missed out.
Can you spot the difference between a leopard and a jaguar? Do you know what flamingos eat that turns them pink? Or why polar bears walk pigeon-toed? If you're curious, get the facts. The Wildlife Fact File. Every page brings you closer to a new understanding.
It was this giant binder filled with all these animal facts. Species were divided into 11 different sections, but it was card 151 that was my favorite. The spotted hyena. The cover of the booklet shows this hyena standing so majestically on the bones of who knows what.
looking into the distance of the African savanna, its mane blowing in the wind. Back then, I didn't understand how it could be hard to love this animal. Then The Lion King came out.
Danger? Ha! I walk on the wild side. I laugh in the face of danger. Ha 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 ha!
Well, 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 Banzai, what have we got here?
I don't know, Shenzi. What do you think, Ed?
Too bad. It's really too bad that Disney portrayed them in the same way as Hemingway, as these sad yowlers who bite your nose off as you sleep, and that steal food that rightfully belongs to lions, when in fact it's the other way around. The lions, it turns out, are stealing from them.
That's right. Turns out young Simba there should be the one we consider the scavenger. But the more and more I went through Sai's book, the more it helped me understand, better than fact files ever could, that it may possibly, perhaps, be difficult to live around hyenas.
And I can understand how, if you live in hyena habitat, how it would irritate you if a hyena bit off your child's nose or dug up your grandma. I mean, these, and the rolling and vomit. But then who doesn't, right? But, you know, I can see how they got that bad reputation, but they needed someone like Kay.
Kay Holkamp is the hyena scientist who the book is named after. She's also a zoologist for Michigan State University. She spends her summers in Masai Mara, which is a part of the Serengeti ecosystem in Kenya, and has been studying hyenas for 30 years.
The thing about hyenas, though, I think that's really revelatory is that here is one of the very few large mammals that we know of that's run by the females.
The matriarchy.
Yes.
That's incredible.
Yes.
They're more forward-thinking than our society. What's not to love?
And the other thing with the women is that they were also larger?
Like yes.
The males?
Yeah, than they're the males. 10% larger, and you look underneath at their equipment, it looks exactly like a male, to the extent that the first folks that went to capture some to take them back for exhibit at zoos was just finding males, and they were complaining about, I can't find any females, and right at that moment, one of the males gave birth.
Dee White is a member of Kay's team, and she's compared the organ to which hyenas give birth to a soda straw. Marinate on that for a second. But let me drop a little more hyena knowledge on you.
When they're born, is it their rank or their position within that clan has already been determined?
Yes, exactly, just like royalty. And whether they, you know, the queen has a boy or a girl, once those infants are out of the burrow, out of, you know, their den, every single male, no matter how high ranking the male, defers to every single infant.
The infant is considered part of the female, and as we've learned, every female outranks every male. Hyena clans can number from 10 to 100, and they have a regimented social system, very much like a kingdom.
So where are hyenas found?
Just about everywhere in Africa south of the Sahara.
You know, when they're hunting, how fast can they go?
They can run 30 miles an hour for 2 miles.
And how big are they? Like, they look like dogs, but...
They can get about a big female about 130 pounds. They would weigh more than I do.
And so let's say 130 pounds?
Yeah.
When it's feeding, or what does its diet consist of? Like that 130-pound female.
They will eat anything. I mean, they'll eat a turtle. They would, you know, they will eat a wildebeest. A single female can take down a bull wildebeest.
That's incredible.
Now, they usually like to work together, but a single, that's like me taking down a wildebeest with my face.
Making all of this information engaging for any audience is what Sai's work is all about. She says a lot of the time when it comes to books on animals, some authors never get into the field. They might visit a zoo, or they might visit a library. For her series, Scientists in the Field, she, along with photographer Nick Bishop, whose work is absolutely stunning, spends time with the expert on their turf. And studying misrepresented animals, as you can imagine, has put her in some interesting situations. Like when she was chased by a silverback gorilla in Zaire.
Oh, yeah. You were bit by a vampire bat in Costa Rica.
Well, that's because I picked it up.
You swam with electric eels.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I've touched electric eels, and you certainly know you've touched the eel in captivity. I mean, your hand just flies out of the water, but it's nothing worse than sticking your hand in a light socket. So
yeah, but, nothing yeah. worse than that.
Well, right. Yeah. Yeah. What the one that freaks out a lot of people is I got for my first book that I did with Nick, the first in the series of Scientists in the Field. I got to work in a pit, the largest snake pit in the world, with 18,000 snakes.
In case you're wondering, that snake pit's in Manitoba, Canada. As I'm packing up, feeling excited to spread the good hyena gospel, Sai stops me. She tells me she's got a surprise for me.
All right, so I'm coming by you.
Soon, we're heading to her car with Thurber, her dog.
He likes this particular song.
She says something she misses about Africa is the sound she would hear at night.
Particularly the...
Sai turns on the car radio. She's in the driver's seat. I'm in the passenger seat. And with his little paws on the center console, Thurber leans forward into the mic. Sai Montgomery, animal lover and author. Her latest work, The Hyena Scientist, came out in hardcover earlier this week and is available wherever you go to find good books.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby. I'm in the studio with one of our producers today, Jimmy Gutierrez. Hi, Jimmy.
Hey, Taylor.
So we got this question from a listener who submitted it as part of our Only in New Hampshire series. Eleanor wrote in to ask, are potatoes famous in New Hampshire? And I don't know about you, but I thought the phrasing was a little strange.
Are potatoes famous in New Hampshire?
Yeah. So I decided to investigate, and I figured why not just take a little office poll.
Do you know potatoes?
Like about like what a potato is?
Yeah.
I think most people know what a potato is, yeah.
How long have you known potatoes?
Since day one.
I come from a long line of potato eaters.
You know Cardi B?
No.
So would you say that potatoes are more famous than Cardi B?
Maybe. Yes, I guess.
I'd say Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
George Clooney, potatoes.
Like Tom Brady and potatoes are as famous as each other.
Agreed.
All right, so I think that pretty much decides it, that yes, indeed, potatoes are famous in New Hampshire.
All right.
Question answered.
There you go, Eleanor. I hope I hope that satisfies your craving.
Another service done by New Hampshire Public Radio and word of mouth. No, but seriously, she may have been asking whether or not New Hampshire has a famous connection to potatoes more generally. And I found that the answer is intriguing. So it led me one rainy spring morning to South Main Street in Derry.
Ooh, let's hear it.
So tell me a little bit about why we're standing where we're standing.
Well, we're standing at where the first potato was planted in North America.
This is Rick Holmes. He's short, bearded, and bespectacled. Over the phone, he joked that I'd recognize him because he looks like a demented Santa Claus.
Well, my grandfather was a full-time farmer. My father was a part-time farmer. And so I went to college, so I didn't have to be a farmer. And so I could go out there and raise cane rather than potatoes.
Rick is retired now, but for years he was the town historian in Derry. He's got one of his books stuffed into the pocket of his fishing vest, and he's using an old family potato hoe as a cane.
There's too many people who don't know anything about Derry.
He agreed to meet me out here because, as he said, Derry was once home to North America's first official tater patch. But like a lot of things in New England, the potato had a roundabout way of getting here.
The potato came from South America, was brought by the Spanish to Europe.
From Spain, it made its way to England and then Ireland.
Now back in 1718, I was a young man then.
Back then, a group of Northern Irish, sometimes called the Scotch Irish, sailed to the New World. They were led by a man named...
James MacGregor, the Reverend James MacGregor. Now, he was very famous in Northern Ireland and Scotland. He was known as the Peacemaker.
You'll see the name MacGregor plastered all over Derry, and that's because the Peacemaker and 200 or so members of his congregation made their way up from Boston to settle in southeastern New Hampshire, bringing with them a whole bunch of seed potatoes.
Which they planted right here.
When you say right here, I mean we're standing on the side of a road by school. You mean right here, like
right
where
here.
We're paved?
Right where we are.
It's not an especially agrarian-looking landscape. What used to be the nation's first potato patch has long since been paved over to make way for a big apartment complex. But at the bottom of a nearby hill, you'll find a little evidence of MacGregor's potatoes, West Running Brook. It's a 5-foot-wide stream that once supplied the water for those inaugural tubers and was later made famous by the poet Robert Frost.
What does it think it's doing running west when all the other country brooks flow east to reach the ocean? It must be the brook.
Derry, it turns out, has no shortage of historical footnotes worth mentioning.
Now you can't swing a dead cat around by the tail without hitting something which is historical.
But still, New Hampshire isn't exactly famous for its potatoes. Maybe Derry has so much history, there isn't enough time to spend on spuds.
So is there a plaque or anything? Is there anything to, I mean, this is kind of a big thing.
Back around 1954, the Potato Institute of America hired a architect to design a huge monument for here. But they didn't have enough money.
Just like the Washington Monument.
The Washington Monument that wasn't completed for many years. It was reported in Yankee Magazine that the town of Derry was trying to find a boulder shaped like a potato so we could use it as a monument.
Derry never did get a potato obelisk, but for years, they did have a hand-painted potato-shaped sign on the side of the road. And in 2012, an elementary class at the Derry Village School took up the cause.
This project with the potato just kind of came organically.
Amy Landry is a fourth grade teacher at the school, which lies on the other side of the hill near West Running Brook.
Every year, the fourth grade goes on a field trip to the state house.
They learn how legislators debate bills and vote. They learn about state symbols like the purple finch, the old man of the mountain. And in 2012, when they got back to class,
they just were like, well, what if we came up with one? And I was just like, all right, do it.
At first, they wanted to go for the state color, but the class couldn't decide between white, purple, and green. And then
one little girl raised her hand and said, well, what about the potato? And everybody just started talking about it, and the light bulb went in my head, and I'm like, oh, here we go.
The kids, with Rick and Amy's help, built the case for making the white potato the state's official vegetable. The timing didn't work out that year, but by the following session, legislators had introduced a bill.
Well, it's important because it was brought forward by fourth graders from the Derry Village School.
And the kids from Derry Village School bust in to see the action.
And they were actually up in the galley watching and listening to the debate happen.
I went to the grocery store last night and there are several kinds of potatoes. Is the white potato a distinctive potato?
Members of the legislature decided to give the fourth graders a little bit of a show. A couple of them argued a healthier option like broccoli would make a better state vegetable.
And it was nerve-wracking because I'm thinking, please pass this. Don't, please, please, oh.
Thank you very much for your poignant testimony. I appreciate it. It just brings back the 1/8 part Irish that I am.
It passed, and it was just an amazing experience.
Of course, New Hampshire isn't much of a potato producer these days.
It appears that potatoes really aren't even counted as a commodity in New England, except for in Maine.
This is Gail McWilliam Jelly, director of New Hampshire's Division of Agricultural Development. She says that the few potatoes that New Hampshire farmers are growing don't have roots in Reverend McGregor's crop.
Color potatoes, you know, the purple potatoes and the red ones and fingerlings and things like that.
So those are like the hip potatoes right now?
Kinda, yeah, you see them everywhere.
So, final answer. Does New Hampshire have famous potatoes? Well, maybe not Tom Brady famous. But thanks to storytellers like Rick and an ambitious pack of fourth graders, Derry's potatoes are on the map. Maybe they just need a bigger marker.
If anyone out there knows where we can get a potato-shaped bowler and can have it delivered, we would appreciate it.
So, Jimmy, what do you think of potatoes? Are you for or against?
Ooh, I am very pro-potato.
Yeah?
Yeah, sweet potato above all. But there's not a potato I won't rock with.
Rick Holmes from The Story, I asked him when I was asking him about types of potatoes. He couldn't remember the name of sweet potato. He called them the orange ones.
Rick.
Now, do we specifically say that we're the first North American potato or the first North American white potato? Is there a...
Well, yeah. The first North American white potato as opposed to those orange things. Yeah. What do you call those? Sweet potatoes.
He's a white potato kind of guy.
Yeah, all the, well, you know, that's Derry, New Hampshire history right there. Yeah.